Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, today, during his press conference in London with outgoing British Prime Minister Theresa May, President Trump dismisses London protests, says he would have sued the EU over Brexit, and a bunch of other things. On the second day of his three-day visit to Britain, the president spoke with Prime Minister Theresa May while protesters mobilized in London. That big fat blimp with the diaper was floating around Trafalgar Square. He said today that he believed Brexit would eventually happen, adding that Britain is a very, very special place, and I think it deserves a special place. During the press conference, he also spoke on a trade deal, Huawei, Mr. Trump's critics, and tariffs on Mexico. What are we to make of all of this? Well, for insight, we turn to my first guest. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. He is Daniel Lazar. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, before I get to the specifics, after listening to the press conference today and the media coverage of Trump's second day in London, he apparently had a wonderful time with the Queen and her crew yesterday. And then today, he's with outgoing Prime Minister Theresa May. Your thoughts on the visit and what you heard in today's press conference?
Well, I mean, what really got me was Trump's comment about the National Health Service. That was really an amazing comment. Did you hear about that?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, that was one of the points I was going to get to. But so go ahead.
Well, I mean, like, I mean, trade is being interpreted as a way of essentially imposing U.S. policy on other nations, and a very right-wing U.S. policy at that. So Trump is essentially trying to somehow dismantle Britain's beloved National Health Service. And it's an absolute outrage, but it's very interesting that he thinks he can do it because, there is some real muscle behind this.
To this point, Trump suggested and U.S. Ambassador Woody Johnson amplified that health care would be on the table in future U.S.-UK trade talks. So this is really the United States trying to impose neoliberal policy on the British government on what is considered by them to be one of their most sacred social programs.
Yes, and also neoliberal policy that is so pointedly anti-social. I mean, essentially Trump wants to make Britain as sick as America is. America is a country which spends more per capita on healthcare than any other country in the world and has the worst outcomes. The American health profile is disastrous. In fact, it's a national emergency. Average life expectancy has fallen for 3 years in a row. It's really a scandal. It should be a scandal. The scandal is that it's not a scandal. But essentially, Trump wants to Americanize British health so that American companies can make more money. I find this really, really outrageous.
In fact, one of the most resonant arguments in the whole Brexit campaign was that by leaving the EU, that Britain would regain control of its money. And by regaining control of its money, it could invest in the health system, because one of the complaints about the health system was wait times, even though all political stripes love the system, but they just felt that some tweaks needed to be made to it. And again, by reclaiming their currency, by taking back control of their money, they would then be able to invest in the health system. So this is directly contradictory to one of the fundamental tenets or arguments for Brexit.
Yes, but that argument has fallen by the wayside, you know, months ago.
Right.
I mean, especially the whole purpose of Brexit is to Trumpize Great Britain. I mean, essentially, it's to push Britain in the direction of a radically egotistical anti-social society. Just what Trump wants to do to the United States. That's the purpose of Brexit in Britain. And that's why people like Boris Johnson, you know, kind of who was kind of a British Trump, has been such an important exponent of Brexit. But to me, I'm just struck how cannibalistic U.S. capitalism has become. I mean, it wants to make money by lowering health standards, lowering the health profile of Britain. They want to make Britons as sick and unhealthy and drug addicted as Americans. And this is really a let them eat cake moment as far as I'm concerned.
Is cannibalizing the health service a cloaked or not so veiled austerity measure?
Well, yes. I mean, first of all, the Tories pay lip service to the NHS, but the Tories have promoted privatization and the development of a two-tier health system in which those with money get better care than those without. And the result is that NHS becomes is on its way to becoming a healthcare provider of last resort. It's an absolute tragedy if this happens, but that's what the thrust of Tory policies are. And certainly if Boris Johnson becomes the next prime minister, that will definitely be the case. And Brexit seems to be designed to push Britain in that direction. So the whole idea of using Brexit to shore up NHS was pure demagoguery. But now Trump is thrusting in the knife and giving it a good sharp twist by trying to use Brexit to create an opening for American healthcare companies so they can do to Britons what they've already done to the United States to Americans, which is to make them sicker and shorter lived and more drug addicted.
Now, the British media has reported that you mentioned Boris Johnson, that he turned down a meeting with Trump with the excuse that he had a scheduling conflict. Now, this morning, the Press Association reported that Trump and Johnson had a friendly and productive 20-minute call. But again, Johnson declined meeting in person. Anything to be read into that?
I don't know what to make of it. I mean, Johnson's playing politics, and he figures that Trump may hinder more than help him at this point. It's unclear. I'm not close enough to the scene, but Trump and Johnson are brothers under the skin.
No question about that. But do you get a sense that, to your point about Johnson playing politics, with the reported size of the protests today, that Boris Johnson kind of looked out his window, saw the big baby Trump in the diaper floating around Trafalgar Square, and said, bring this guy over to my house for a tea and crumpets is probably not a good idea.
You're probably right. You're probably right. I mean, he may have decided to cool it a bit to sort of play down the whole raging, egotist angle that Trump represents. But I still think that Boris Johnson is essentially a Donald Trump with a floppy hairdo.
I like that. Labor Party leader Jeremy Corbyn addressed anti-Trump protesters in the streets before the news conference got underway. Now, Trump said at the news conference that he had declined meeting with Corbyn, who he described as a negative fellow. But the Labor Party press team responded that Corbyn proposed a meeting with Trump during the visit and that Corbyn is ready to engage with the president on a range of issues, including the climate emergency, threats to peace, and the refugee crisis. Your thoughts there?
Well, I mean, I'm not close enough to be able to really, give a good, detailed reading about what's going on. But there's an ocean of difference between Jeremy Corbyn and Donald Trump. They're polar opposites. I mean, there's an ocean of difference between the two men. And so Trump doesn't want to talk to Corbyn. Trump wants to, he wants to posture. He wants to wage war. He wants to insult. He's not interested in an exchange of ideas or a meeting of the minds. I mean, that's ridiculous. Trump is never interested in that.
It's kind of ironic to me that Trump's ally, Boris Johnson turned down a face-to-face meeting, while Corbyn, the negative fellow, requested a meeting, or at least expressed willingness to meet, and Trump turned him down. Go ahead.
Trump is a master
marketer,
strategician, strategist, and so he knows who he wants to talk to and when he wants to talk to them. So he would have been happy to meet with Corbyn, but with Boris Johnson, he does not want to meet with Corbyn because he doesn't see any advantage in it. And as I said before, the last thing the guy wants is a meeting of the minds.
Now, he complimented Theresa May as a tremendous professional and a person who loves her country dearly, but he had insulted her up to that point, saying basically that she mismanaged Brexit. He gave her advice that she didn't take, that he would have sued the EU, which she didn't do. Listening to him today demonstrated to me, now, however you feel about Theresa May's politics, her professionalism as well as diplomacy by not just turning to him and saying, "You lying dog, how can you stand here before the world and say what you just said? Because you're just a lying dog." Go ahead.
Trump is a wrecker. He really is. I mean, he's a saboteur. He wants Brexit. A non-negotiated Brexit, and so because he wants to wreck stuff, he wants to wreck the EU and he wants to wreck the British economy, so to make it safe for U.S. corporations to get in there and do business at the expense of British society. And there are, and more importantly, there are elements like that at work in Britain as well, and who want to essentially, Trumpize the economy to make it safe for the big corporations at the expense of the average person in the street. So, this is really dangerous. It's really insidious. It's really going very far. And that NHS comment really, really was a real red flag as far as I'm concerned.
Even more so of a red flag than his starting the Twitter war with London Mayor Sadiq Khan?
Well, of course. Trump is a guy, he's on a rampage. And he's stronger now than he was a few months ago because back in the U.S., Russiagate has broken in his favor due to the monumental incompetence of the Democratic Party. So Trump is feeling his oats. He's back in his bull in the China shop routine. He's smashing stuff, insulting Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London. Calling for a full Brexit and declaring war on the NHS of all things. So the guy's on a roll. It's not very pleasant to watch.
Now, I may have missed this, and I don't think I did. I did not hear anybody in the press corps ask about Julian Assange.
Yeah, I didn't hear that either. I'm not surprised.
No, I'm not surprised. I wish that someone would have had the guts to ask the question, especially with Theresa May standing there next to Trump. That would have been a great question. I know we've talked about this yesterday, but your thoughts, again, on I don't think we can have a conversation about Trump in London and not have a conversation about Julian Assange.
Well, Jeremy Corbyn, to his great credit, has said he would not extradite Assange to the U.S. And drew howls of protest from the right-wing press. But this is really Corbyn at his best. But If there's a Tory government and the extradition request comes in, I'm confident they will abide by it if Sweden doesn't get Assange first. And so, with British help, Assange could find himself clapped in a maximum security prison for the rest of his life. That's a pretty horrible thing to imagine.
So Donald Trump went to London, he met with the Queen. He got to see the collection of gifts exchanged between United States presidents and people in London, the Queen and them. There was no trade deal done. And Theresa May's on her way out as of Friday, I think. So he's talking to a prime minister who day after tomorrow will no longer be the prime minister. Was this a dog and pony show with no pony?
Well, yes, I think it is. I mean, I think, look at Britain's in deep, deep trouble. I mean, Brexit is a colossal foul up. They have just dug themselves, they painted themselves to a corner, and there's no way out. And the British society is going to pay a huge price. And British workers, the people who rely on things like the NHS, will pay an even greater price. But, you know, Trump-style, you know, businessmen, business elements and corporations hope to profit, and they very possibly will. But, you know, but Britain is facing a real calamity, and Trump is now sort of, you know, coming in the final stages and sort of trumpeting his success and palling around with people like Boris Johnson or making nice noises about them. It's a real grotesque display.
And looking at upcoming elections, Boris Johnson, Jeremy Corbyn, if you turn on your crystal ball, I know you had it repaired yesterday. So if you turn on your crystal ball and look for the future, what's the future telling you?
I don't know. I mean the problem is that Corbyn has handled Brexit really poorly, really poorly. I mean, Corbyn did not want to discuss Brexit. He was blindsided by it as well. The Labour message on Brexit has been extremely muddy. You know, Corbyn could conceivably have turned Brexit to his advantage, but he has not. So people, you know, people may think Corbyn's a good guy, and he may be a good guy, but he's not especially visionary or bold on this issue. And so, therefore, the Labour seems to be suffering almost as much as the Tories are. The Tories are in ruins, but Labour is not doing very well either. So therefore, as to who wins the next general election, it's hard to project. I would actually think, though, however, that the Tories may have the edge at this point.
And the Brexit Party is a one issue party, and so we'll just have to see how that all shakes out. Daniel Lazar, journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. As always, Daniel, thank you so much for your contribution to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, President Trump says tariffs on Mexican imports will take effect next week, despite Mexican optimism for a deal. While Trump's tariffs could nullify tax cut, clouding economic picture, and Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome H. Powell is eyeing the potential for President Trump's trade war to inflict damage on the United States economy, saying that the central bank is prepared to act to sustain the economic expansion if needed. How does all of this uncertainty portend for the U.S. economic future? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Dr. Linwood Taheed. Dr. Taheed, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Dr. Leon. Good to be here.
So I combined three stories from today's papers that I thought made sense to discuss in one segment. I hope you think my logic, or as we would say, my thesis, makes sense here.
Okay.
Let's start with the tariffs on Mexican goods. President Trump warned today that he will impose a 5% tariff on Mexican imports starting next week and then increase the levies each month if the border with the U.S. isn't closed to migrants, saying Republican lawmakers would be foolish to try to stop him. He is suggesting that the imposition on tariffs on June 10 is nearly inevitable, despite pleas from GOP lawmakers to reconsider as they warn of ruinous economic consequences. First, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and other top administration officials plan to meet with Mexican leaders tomorrow. Do you see this as a last-minute negotiation threat, or do you expect him to follow through?
Well, I suspect that this is a negotiation threat. What Republicans and others are saying about the economic consequences of tariffs, Mexico, and then, you know, we've seen tariffs with China having devastating effect on Midwest farmers particularly, they're correct. There will be devastating effects, and for the president to use this for another agenda item to get his, wall or security on the border is, I think, out of place.
The president has said Mexico shouldn't allow millions of people to try to enter our country, and they should stop it very quickly, and I think they will. That's what the president says. Your thoughts as an economist on using economic policy to thwart this, what I think is a catastrophe caused by the president, but using economic threats as to leverage this type of policy, your thoughts as an economist?
Well, I mean, I guess there's a political and an economic thought on this. If the intention is simply to try to get Mexico to shut down its side of the border, then if Mexico does that, then the policy has worked and the president doesn't have to then put tariffs in place. However, if Mexico balks at that and doesn't do what they're being threatened with, then if the president therefore instigates a tariff, then that will hurt U.S., the U.S. economy. And so, it's shooting the U.S. in the foot.
The second point here, and you just touched on this, there are pleas from GOP lawmakers to reconsider as they warn of ruinous economic consequences. What would the import penalties do to the U.S. economy? Give us some examples of how this is going to directly impact the United States economy.
Well, all tariffs could be thought of as taxes. And so as the Mexican economy is sending things, selling things to U.S. consumers, the tariff will increase the cost of those items. You know, there'll be a tax put on. That tax will be collected by the federal government. But then that tax has to be passed on to consumers, and so those products will be more expensive. And, you know, that not only includes agricultural products that we buy from Mexico, but also things like automobiles that are, cross the border many times between the U.S. and Mexico. And if there's a tariff put on those items, then those kind of things will increase in their prices. The federal government will collect the tax, but consumers therefore have to pay that tax eventually.
And GOP lawmakers are warning that this also, these tariffs could imperil the chances of passing what they label as the overhaul of NAFTA. And it's also interesting that from the data that I'm looking at, Mexico sends 80% of its exports to the U.S. We're Mexico's top trading partner.
Right.
So if the U.S. weakens the Mexican economy, we're weakening the economy of one of our closest neighbors other than Canada. To me, it's almost along the lines of why would you devalue the property of your next door neighbor? Because that's only going to have an impact on your property value.
Exactly. And think about it, immigrants from Mexico and further south are coming to the U.S. for a couple of reasons. The further south immigrants are to escape persecution. But Mexican immigrants are coming to the U.S. to work. And if their economy gets worse, then they will want to come to the U.S. to be employed. And so it's actually going, the unintended, if you will, or expected consequence of weakening the Mexican economy is actually more immigration across the border, not less.
And, to your point, when you look at individuals from Honduras, when you look at individuals from El Salvador, when you look at individuals from Guatemala, people that are coming here through Mexico, they're coming escaping horrendous conditions in their countries.
Correct.
Many of which have been created, if not exacerbated, by U.S. foreign policy in their countries. So the United States is creating the very catastrophes that they now are blaming Mexico for not stopping the people who are fleeing those catastrophes.
You're absolutely correct. And if the tariff actually begins to affect the Mexican economy, then now you'll have Mexico, which is, you know, fairly stable
right.
in this process of immigrants. I mean, we're actually having a reverse flow of Mexican citizens going back to Mexico because their economy has been doing fairly well. But if their economy begins to decline, then that flow will reverse.
Let's move to the second issue. Trump's tariffs could nullify tax cut, clouding economic picture. President Trump's tax cuts provided a temporary jolt to the U.S. economy by putting more money into taxpayers' pockets. This may sound like a sophomoric question, but let's start with how the tariffs that Trump has grown so fond of may now have the opposite effect.
Well, I think I'm going to disagree a little bit because I wanted to do the analysis on who the Trump tax cuts benefited.
Thank you very much. I set you up with that point. Go ahead.
Right. Yeah, we're talking about a tax cut that benefited the wealthy, but we're talking about tariffs that are going to hurt the poor mm-hmm. and middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And so either way, the poor and middle class get the short end of the stick. They didn't get the tax breaks that they were promised. Those went to the wealthy. And the greater effect of that was to see, for example, stock buybacks on Wall Street pushing up of Wall Street prices, but very little in terms of benefit to a middle class and poor taxpayers. In fact, at the end of the day, April 15th, many taxpayers found that their tax bills were higher than they had been before.
But the story was that, you saw the increase in your take-home pay in your monthly check because payroll taxes were supposed to be reduced. And so people were seeing allegedly $100 or $200 more a month per paycheck. And so the counter to the point that you just made is, of course you're going to see a higher tax bill on April 15th. Because you got more take-home pay in your check every week before that.
That's correct. The guidance from the IRS to employers was to reduce withholding. But what they didn't know was that at the end of the day, on April 15th, that withholding needed to be paid back,
mm-hmm.
plus in some cases some additional. So persons ended up over the year owing more and paying more in taxes than they had before. So it was a shell game.
Or as they would say, I giveth with the right and taketh with the left.
Yes, and taketh more with the left.
And taketh more with the left, and which I would because I'm left-handed. Okay, so now then, there are two new analyses that show, this is according to Washington Post, that the tariffs Trump is using to punish China, Mexico, Europe, and other governments would more than wipe out the gains from his $1.5 trillion tax cut, allegedly for low and middle income earners, as we're just talking about, leaving them with less money. So explain again, I need to connect the dots clearly between the tariff and the tax cut. Why did you say that it benefited the wealthy but hurt the working and middle class?
Well, we're talking about the tax cuts, which benefited the wealthy. They were skewed towards persons of wealth. I mean, the old canard was that if you give money to the job creators, then they will invest in their companies and expand business, and people will become employed, and wages will go up.
Wasn't that introduced to us as Reaganomics, as trickle-down economics, as at the time, Republican presidential candidate against Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, called it voodoo economics. Did you study voodoo economics when you were working on getting your degree?
No. Well, you know, study it to know that it was voodoo economics. But, you know, but that economics, you know, it didn't start with Reagan. It actually, you know, goes back quite a ways to the early 20th century, where it was called horse and sparrow economics.
Okay.
That is, if you feed the horse, then eventually the sparrow can eat. You know, once the horse has eliminated its oats, the sparrow can eat some of the oats, you know, but they, you know, trickle-down economics is a polite way of saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Give money to the wealthy, and eventually it'll trickle down to the poor. But, of course, it never happens that way. It hasn't happened that way. The poor, the wealthy take their money and invest it in the things that are going to create income for them, and not necessarily in their companies. The old idea of reinvesting of all profits back into a company is an old idea which does not occur in modern economies.
Investors, bond markets, and Wall Street analysts are now seemingly increasingly alarmed by the potential slowdown in growth that they fear will come from these trade escalations. Are you projecting the same fear?
Well, we're already seeing, of course, devastation in the Midwest with farmers who have lost their trade with China. Being propped up by subsidies, of course, the Midwest farmers are also being hit by flooding, which is now a double disaster for them. But we've already seen that slowdown. And one of the things that, I guess there's the story about the Federal Reserve saying that they will do what they can to stimulate the economy to offset the negative effects of the trade war. Unfortunately, the Federal Reserve can do very little to stimulate the economy. What they can do is lower interest rates, but if businesses are seeing a decrease in demand for their products, like soybean farmers seeing a decrease in their demand for soybeans because Chinese are not buying them, then they're not going to borrow money. So lower interest rates won't help in that instance.
Now, the president insisted on Monday via Twitter that his tariffs are not hurting Americans and that his trade policy will help create jobs and investment in the U.S., quote, no visible increase in cost of inflation, but U.S. is taking billions. So he's trying to sell the idea that somehow, I guess, the U.S. Treasury is making money off of these tariffs.
Well, the U.S. Treasury, in fact, does collect the tariff to collect the tax. So there's an increase in revenue into the government as a result of the tariffs. It's a tax, but that tax is going to have to be paid by consumers. So anyone who buys these products that are now more costly will have to pay more. And so, this is extraction from those who are buying these products into the government. It's not going to be enough normally an increase in taxes might yield an increase in federal spending, but that's not going to happen as well. And so when we see Republicans becoming alerted to the problems of these tariffs, it's because they've had their negative effect from the Chinese tariffs on their constituents in Midwest and farm countries, and they're not wanting to go through a second round of this.
Final point, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell, and you touched on this, but I'd like for you to elaborate a little more. He's eyeing the potential for Trump's trade war to inflict damage on the U.S. economy. He said that the central bank is prepared to act to sustain the economic expansion if needed. Now, understanding that Fed chairs talk in cloaked language and subtleties, what are your takeaways from Powell's message, and is it coincidence that he was on 60 Minutes this past Sunday?
Well, I think what Powell has to do is to attempt to say the right things so that he'll stay in favor with the president. But unfortunately, the Federal Reserve in doing what is called monetary policy and, let's say, decreasing interest rates is part of that. The Federal Reserve can do very little to stimulate an economy. There's a metaphor that is easy, I think, easy to understand. The metaphor is pushing on a string.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you tie a string to an object and you pull it, the object will move with it. And so, for example, when the economy is heating up and doing well, if the Federal Reserve increases interest rates, then that slows the economy down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pulling on the string. On the other hand, when the economy is faltering, when demand is decreasing, when it's going into recession, if the Federal Reserve decreases interest rates, that's pushing on the string. Now, if you push on the string, the object on the other end, the recession, the economy, is not going to move. So monetary policy, what the Federal Reserve does, is asymmetric. It can slow the economy down, but it can't speed the economy up. And so, unfortunately, when Powell is with saying this, he's saying the right things so that the president will hear that he's with him. But if they were actually to implement lower interest rates to try to stimulate the economy to offset the effects of the tariffs, there will be very little, if any, effect from that. And so monetary policy is not the thing to do.
Final question to that point, and just to put a bow around or use that string to put a bow around it. One of the issues that I've been reading about is how the markets have become used to artificially cheap money, with interest rates being artificially depressed for a very long period of time.
Right.
Is that real, and is that an ongoing concern?
Well, interest rates have been low, particularly since the 2008 recession. The Federal Reserve has been trying to to keep interest rates low to stimulate the economy. And so those rates have only begun to go up recently, but they're still low. You know, 2.5% is what's called the federal funds rate. The Federal Reserve sets that, or at least attempts to set that. And that's a low rate, but that low rate is still not stimulating borrowers, let's say, to borrow money, businesses to borrow money. It's because there's less demand out there for products, and people are still concerned about their jobs and about their income. Wages have not gone up. And so the Federal Reserve has been attempting to set low interest rates, has been feeding money into the banking system, and that money has been sitting in banks. It's not been borrowed.
Dr. Linwood Tahid from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for coming back to the Critical Hour. And, man, I look forward to having you back.
Thank you. These are some complicated issues, so I hope I've been articulate on this. But thank you.
No question. That's why I called you, because you're the one to make it clear. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
All right, folks. You are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, the Washington Office on Latin America gets behind U.S. regime change agenda in Venezuela. This is another great Mint Press story, and we're joined by its author, a staff writer for Mint Press News based in Washington. He reports on police, prisons, and protests in the United States and the United States policing of the world. He previously reported for RT and Sputnik News, Alexander Rubenstein. Alexander, as always, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Terry Matson with the campaign to end U.S. and Canadian sanctions against Venezuela. Now, today, she's joining us from San Francisco. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So, Alex, let's start with who is the Washington Office on Latin America?
Well, supposedly it's a human rights NGO, but it really operates more like a foreign policy think tank, kind of like, you know, the Atlantic Council or Brookings Institution or any of these other ultra-hawkish institutions in Washington. It's consistently taken a line that is, it kind of toes this line where it does its best to avoid endorsing anything that is, you know, counter to human rights, but wherever the United States seeks regime change, it happens to fall in line with that, whether that be Honduras or now in Venezuela.
And you referenced this June 1 press release ostensibly urging the return of democracy to Venezuela. Talk about that, please.
Yeah, I mean, so they haven't endorsed Juan Guaido, but they denounce Nicolas Maduro at every turn. They also, in that press release, called for multilateral sanctions against Venezuela that don't, they specify that they don't harm the population, but it's really difficult to imagine, and Terry can speak this to this a little bit better, I would think, but it's difficult to imagine sanctions that don't. And really, they haven't been multilateral. They've been unilateral coercive measures by the United States that are now, as I spoke to you the other week, targeting the government food distribution program. And really, the sanctions on the oil industry have done a good amount of damage to the Venezuelan economy, and not just to the government, but to the people, because that's where the government gets its money to provide all these services that it does, whether it be housing or food or what have you.
So based upon your research and in your opinion, what's the significance of the Washington Office on Latin America taking the position that they've taken?
Well, I mean, it's a hugely powerful human rights NGO. It's like up there with Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. And I mean, it really squeezes out other activist groups, other advocacy groups when it comes to Latin America, because they're just so powerful. So them throwing their weight behind the ouster of Nicolas Maduro is huge. One thing to note about the press release is that they repeatedly call for elections and call for dialogue. But as we saw with the negotiations in Norway, the opposition is unwilling to engage in any kind of dialogue or agree to new elections if Nicolas Maduro runs again. So that just kind of shows you how desperate they are for an uprising that would oust Maduro, because there's no way to do it democratically. And, you know, the Washington Office on Latin America, you know, it hasn't condemned the opposition's violence. It hasn't condemned the military coup. It only condemns Nicolas Maduro. And so in calling for new elections when, you know, it's evident that there's no other way to do it violently, because there's just not the support in Venezuela, you know, the WOLA really shows its face.
Terry, you were in Venezuela as recently as last week. Have you been seeing the work of the Washington Office on Latin America on the ground in Venezuela? And you can define work any way you want to.
Well, I would first like to just follow up on a comment that Alex made about the talks in Norway, and that that WOLA does support those talks, but they do support the opposition position that Maduro has to resign before there's elections versus including him in the electoral process. The interesting thing, and Alex, you really clearly bring this up in your article, with WOLA supporting the talks in Norway, is that the Norwegian Foreign Ministry is a significant donor to WOLA. And Norway is a NATO country. Actually, it's one of the founding NATO countries. So I don't think that we can leave that relationship out of the mix, specifically the NATO factor in the regime change conversation. That is a big part of the regime change conversation. And then as far as my personal experience on the ground in Venezuela.
Hey, hang on one second. Hang on one second there, Terry, because I'd like for you to kind of clarify what I see as a competing interest, for lack of a better word. Norway is a NATO contributor.
Founding member of NATO.
Founding member of NATO. But when the U.S. went to the U.N. seeking U.N. support for its move against Maduro, China and Russia and some other countries on the Security Council blocked the play. So is there some competition between a NATO position here and a U.N. position here? Is that a reasonable question to ask?
I think it's a reasonable question to ask, and it's a reasonable conversation happening, you know, particularly within the Beltway with activists and solidarity movements, that there is perhaps this, you know, this movement to have NATO replace the United Nations and make the United Nations obsolete and have NATO basically the predominant international body. So regarding NATO, it's interesting that one of the neighboring countries to Venezuela, Colombia, is now a NATO member. I don't know how they're qualified. I mean, you know, they're not a North Atlantic country. You know, mm-hmm. They're a Caribbean coastal country, but they're a third tier, I forget exactly how it's qualified, third tier NATO member or partner, third tier partner of NATO. So you have NATO now expanding into the Caribbean. And so I think that that adds, you know, some credibility to your comment, is, you know, our comment about NATO perhaps replacing the UN as a long-range vision.
It's called a partner across the globe is what it's called.
Oh, I like that. Doesn't that sound nice? and friendly. Sounds very nice and friendly when we know it's completely the opposite of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm sorry to have interrupted you, but go ahead.
No. That's okay. Because that's a really worthy, I mean, following this this expansion of NATO across the globe and what's happening internally within the UN is going to be, yeah, fascinating to watch it unfold. And I do personally come from the position that I do believe NATO is being expanded to nullify the UN. I personally believe that is a project at hand. But as far as, you know, sanctions and how, I don't know that anybody would overtly say this is Wola's hand on the ground in Venezuela. They're certainly not helping with their position. And to go from unilateral sanctions to now be suggesting multilateral sanctions, they're saying, you know, so they want more economies, more countries across the globe to shut off their relationship with Venezuela, their trade relationships with Venezuela. And it's interesting to hear a U.S. organization using multilateral, because my impression has always been the U.S. is so focused on promoting unilateralism and only unilateralism. I find it ironic that they're using the term multilateral. But it's bad for everyone there with these sanctions. These are, you know, the U.S. is very nice in saying that sanctions are targeted to individuals, to businesses, institutions. But the resulting factor is those businesses, institutions, and governmental agencies can no longer service the population. So it is the population that suffers. And it is, regardless of political affiliation, unless you happen to be a Guaido supporter with a lot of U.S. dollars sitting in the bank in Miami, you know, it's really tough in Venezuela right now for everyone, particularly women and children. And, you know, there is no specific targeting of sanctions once they start hitting the broad population. They affect everyone. And now with this potential or the slap with the subsidized food program, this is nothing more than murder of innocent civilians. This is nothing short of murder. I don't think that you can use any word softer than that to describe. This is an overt attempt to starve the Venezuelan people into submission and possibly into death. And I don't think that's too strong of a statement to say death and murder.
The last count I heard, and I hope I got this number right, 40,000 people have died as a result of this. Is that a good number?
Well, that's the number that's been cited in the Center for Economic Progress and Research, the CEPR report that Mark Weisbrod and Jeffrey Sachs produced, which I have to, in my personal experience over the years with Venezuela and having now been there recently for 2 months, I think it's highly accurate. It's one of the better pieces written. That 40,000 could possibly be low.
Okay. Alex, talk about some of these NGOs such as WOLA, the Washington Office on Latin America, and their so-called pro-democracy counterparts, and how they're being used, as some would describe them, as front operations.
Yeah, really quick, I want to note that WOLA, in one of these rounds of sanctions that was part of this larger regime of sanctions by President Trump, they praised the virtues in a number of ways of the sanctions. And as you said, those have led, the larger sanction regime has led to 40,000 deaths. So you can see how much this NGO is really dedicated to human rights. But WOLA is among the ranks of a number of other think tanks and human rights NGOs that are making regime change in Venezuela their top priority. Another great example is Amnesty International, which has consistently campaigned for regime change in Venezuela. They had one really slick video that they produced that was, you know, there was like even opposition, you know, doing things that were almost violent in this video, and they called it Change is Possible. But really, it's not possible electorally. It's just not going to happen. There's too much support for Nicolas Maduro. So when they say change is possible, what they mean is regime change. And what they mean is regime change by American proxies. It should be noted that Popular Will which is Juan Guaido's political party, was propped up really by the United States Agency for International Development, which WOLA has supported all throughout Latin America. USAID, basically, what it does is it buys up NGOs, unions, and they fill it with American cash, and then they, you know, funnel messaging through it that promotes regime change. I'm working on a piece right now about Honduras, where just before the U.S. coup, a U.S.-backed coup there, there was USAID pumped $50 million a year into Honduras, all to support these quote-unquote democracy promotion initiatives. But, you know, in Venezuela and in Honduras, where there was that coup, that unconstitutional, and now there's a president who is supported by the United States who is president unconstitutionally, USAID and the democracy promotion cutouts that it supports have actually advocated against the democracy of Nicolas Maduro and of Manuel Zelaya, who was ousted in a military operation. So really, you see that the human rights is really a canard for a lot of these organizations used to cover for basically furthering Washington's regime change efforts, and it's had disastrous effects. We see that the crisis on the border with Mexico, it comes from three countries in the Northern Triangle mostly, and Honduras is one of those. It's one of the bigger places from which refugees are coming from, and that's because of United States policy. There's been death squads. There's like the president of Honduras was just like named in court papers in Manhattan for being investigated by the Department of Drug Enforcement for drug trafficking. So these are the things that people are trying to escape. And we can see now that the sanctions against Venezuela have also caused a bit of a refugee crisis there. And that's where the human rights issue is. But there's not so much concern from the NGOs and think tanks.
Terry, same question to you, talking about the NGOs and their so-called pro-democracy counterparts. And they're being used as front operations. And again, you're speaking from your experience on the ground.
Well, my personal observation is that these human rights, quote unquote, organizations are promoting this neoliberal capitalist model of forced privatization of natural resources and industry. And you can see that John Bolton has been very clear as to the natural resource grab that he desires in Venezuela, specifically the oil, but Venezuela has diamonds and gold and high-tech minerals as well. And then Alex has just shared with you this massive migration from the Northern Triangle and Central America, and that Honduras specifically, I think we could all attest, anybody who's been there, is that is massive petri dish for forced privatization. And we've seen, you know, the protests this past week in Honduras with the teachers and the healthcare industry, you know, protesting this forced privatization of those industries, which, by the way, is, you know, being presented to our own population here in the United States as well. We just haven't mobilized as they are in Central America. So I don't see this as a human right, so some of these groups as human rights, quote unquote, groups. That's a euphemism that's been really very well curated by the United States. These are groups that, you know, want to, quote unquote, better people's lives through this neoliberal capitalist model of massive privatization of all industry and natural resources. And it's quite violent. And Honduras specifically. And so you do see these people fleeing countries. It's interesting. And I brought this up over and over with many people, particularly here in the States, when people are trying to understand what's happening in Venezuela and yet fail to talk about Honduras. You know, Honduras is a U.S. installed coup regime. But we know that for a fact.
Right.
And many, many of the things that the democratically elected government in Venezuela is accused of doing, we know for a fact the coup installed government in Honduras is doing. And I think for your listeners, one of the things that I like to ask people is if you can really look at and try to understand why people fleeing Venezuela are labeled by the U.S. State Department for immigration purposes. The Venezuelans fleeing are labeled political refugees. The people fleeing, the paradigm being established by the United States and Honduras, the people fleeing Honduras and other and the other two Northern Triangle countries and parts of southern Mexico, they are illegal migrants. They're illegal migrants fleeing Central America, specifically Honduras, and yet they are political refugees fleeing Venezuela. And I think, you know, you can understand why the two are categorized that way by the United States. You kind of understand what's happening, particularly with this expansion of neoliberal capitalism.
Was Elliot Abrams involved in the coup in Honduras? Do you know?
You know, for a fact, I don't know. I don't know for a fact. I mean, we all know his involvement in Central America in the 1980s.
Right. That's why.
We all know his current involvement with Venezuela.
Got you. Wow. Thank you all so much, Alexander Rubenstein and Terry Mattson. Alex's piece, Washington Office on Latin America Gets Behind U.S. Regime Change Agenda in Venezuela. WOLA's hawkish stance on Venezuela may seem surprising for a human rights organization, but it is less of a surprise for those familiar with WOLA's history. You can find that on Mint Press. Alex, thank you so much. Terry Mattson, as always, thank you so much, and look forward to having you all back.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, folks, you have been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.